Hi, I'm Shauna Meyerson with the Yoga of War podcast, here today with return guest, author and scholar David L. Bernstein. If you appreciate and find value in these important discussions, please consider supporting the show so I could continue to bring you such amazing and esteemed guests. Details are pinned in the comments below. And thanks to my incredibly generous mom, Lenny Meyerson, for being the founding sponsor of the show. The last time that David Bernstein was on the Yoga of War podcast, we discussed his groundbreaking book, Woke Antisemitism: How a Progressive Ideology Harms Jews. And we explored the deplorable phenomenon of antisemitism as an offshoot of misguided social justice vis-a-vis the Israel-Hamas war. This time, I approached David with the personal hypothesis that even as the war in Gaza winds down and ultimately ends, global anti-Semitism will continue to rise in direct inverse proportion. That all the so-called social justice warriors who have cried so loudly and violently for ceasefire now were simply using the war as a convenient excuse for flat-out Jew hatred. I presented David with this thesis before the ceasefire was ratified. And I have to say, my premise is so far disappointingly upholding. I'm just as eager as you are to hear his expert view on the state of anti-Semitism, both today and heading into the future. It is my distinct honor and pleasure today to welcome back to the show David L. Bernstein. A passionate advocate for the free expression of ideas, David is the author of Woke Antisemitism and the founder of the Jewish Institute for Liberal Values, which supports viewpoint diversity, counters radical ideologies in the Jewish community, and opposes novel forms of antisemitism emerging from radical social justice ideology. Bernstein previously served as president and CEO of the Jewish Council for Public Affairs, executive director of the David Project, as well as various senior roles with the American Jewish Committee. Bernstein has been a leading advocate for Israel's quest for peace and security on the legislative, diplomatic, media, and intergroup relations fronts. Thank you again for joining me again. David, I really look forward to this discussion.
Great to be back with you.
Thank you. Let's jump right into the deep end. 16 months now after the horrors of 10/7, I have to admit that I am still utterly baffled how vehement and violent Jew hatred has become the new multicultural tolerance. In your opinion, why did the world absolutely trip over itself to get in on the BLM frenzy, yet all but completely wash their hands of any social responsibility when it comes to confronting anti-Semitism?
Yeah, I think what we saw in the last decade or so is the emergence of I'll call it applied intersectionality. You've heard the word intersectionality, and it originally meant something completely different. It was a term coined by a critical race theorist named Kimberlé Crenshaw, and it was about how one's identity can be a source of either privilege or oppression, and then if one was both, was part of more than one oppressed category. So if you were both Black and a woman, you experienced a kind of compound oppression that you didn't experience if you were just Black or a woman. That was the original meaning of the term. But what happened over the years, particularly on college campuses, was that people used the term intersectionality to start connecting various causes. So they said, okay, all the oppressed people of the world are fighting against the same oppressor. And so if you were part of, let's say, the anti-sex violence movement, or Black Lives Matter, or environmental activism, or reproductive justice, all of these various causes were all part of the great war of the oppressed versus the oppressors. And Israel was the perfect oppressor. It was considered the colonizer. Now I know we can argue and do argue and dispute all their definitions about how Israel fits in. Of course, Israel's one of the most diverse countries in the world. Of course, Israel is should be viewed as the oppressed, not the oppressor in the conflict. But that didn't matter. That's how it was coded. And they saw Palestinians and the Palestinian Solidarity Movement, that's what it was called at the time, really, as the sort of paramount oppressor. And I think that's why we're what we're dealing with. There's no nuance at all. So, the fact that gay rights are anything but respected, let's say in Gaza or the West Bank or, in the Palestinian areas, mean nothing to the LGBTQ activist community that wants to be part of this intersectional matrix. So, that had been brewing for a while. I mean, that had been brewing well before October 7th, and it was getting worse, and I could feel it getting worse way before October 7th. I wrote my book a year before October 7th. I wrote it. It was published in October 2022, and a year before. So I was monitoring these trends in liberal left-wing spaces. And so when October 7th came, it had already been, in the pipeline. And what you saw was an explosion. It was like all of a sudden that cause could symbolize all of these other causes. That one cause they could rally around. That one cause, they could say, the Jews in Israel are the ultimate, the paradigmatic oppressors. And that's why I think we saw this tremendous, scourge of anti-Semitism that emerged after October 7th.
Okay, so let me clarify some terms here because you just referred to the reviled group as one of two things. First, Israel, then second, the Jews of Israel. Here's the challenge, and I think you know where I'm going with this. I am not a Jew of Israel. But I am considered to be among, sorry, the same exact uber oppressor class. I mean, this would be like the Black Lives Matter movement turning into a Philo African movement and saying that all Black people in America, we just equate that with Africa. So even if it were a fair argument, which I know you're not saying it is, and I'm definitely saying it's not, that Israel is some sort of oppressor, that does not readily extend to the broad-reaching anti-Semitism that has taken over not just our country, which we'll probably mostly focus on today, but the world.
Yeah, it's a fair point. And there are other, there are other dimensions to this. So one of them is that this ideology, this oppressed oppressor ideology, or whatever we're going to call it, that divides up the world into oppressed and oppressors, looks at average income or wealth, average wealth, not like every Jew's rich. Obviously, that's not the case, but average wealth as a marker of either oppression or privilege. And so we've been, as American Jews have been quoted as have been coded as part of the oppressor class because we're a successful minority community. So by very definition, we must be complicit in the white supremacist superstructure that's holding down the groups that are below the mean. That's the only, if your only explanation for why there's disparity in the world, that some people, that the haves are causing the disparity or the oppression of the have-nots. It's the only way that the world works. Then you're going to look at the world and say, okay, why do some people have more than others? Well, that's because they're oppressing them. They're doing something bad. And so Jews as a group that is largely successful is viewed as doing something bad to the people who are less successful on average. And so that's part of the dynamic. The other part of the dynamic is that when they talk about the situation between Israel and Hamas, they don't just talk about Israel and Israelis. They talk about Zionists. And by that, they're trying to extend the complicity of Israel's supposed genocide or apartheid to all Zionists. That is that mostly American Jews who support Israel's right to exist would all be labeled as Zionists. So therefore, by virtue of your beliefs in the idea of Israel, you are now complicit in what Israel has done in their view to the Palestinians. So those dynamics, I think, come to play as well. So that's why we're not immune. That's why, you know, a restaurant in Brooklyn was just defaced that really, you know, takes no position on the Israel-Palestinian issue. It's just a restaurant that puts out good food. And it was defaced because he's, the owner is a Zionist. And that makes him therefore guilty.
Which goes back to my original argument that this is not actually about Israel. This is about the Jews. But that being said, I think that the thing that bothers me the most is that these progressive liberals who stand for tolerance, it's like they can't even see their own faces contorting in the mirror with the vile in unbridled hatred that they are bringing to the Jewish community. It's really overwhelming. And last time we spoke, we touched upon the concept of the weaponization of words. So my next question is, especially speaking as somebody who comes from a space of liberal values, why are we still referring to jihadi and terrorist ideologies as progressive and liberal?
Yeah, so we're dealing with two different ideologies that have sort of converged with each other. One is, you know, radical social justice ideology in the United States and Europe and in the Anglosphere that, you know, believes that that the reason why there are problems in our unresolved problems is because of that the oppressed are oppressing the oppressors are oppressing the oppressed, right? That's one. Then you have this Islamist ideology, jihadi ideology that. That it's a political philosophy. It's not all of Islam. It's a political philosophy that Islam has been sort of defeated by the West because it lost its bearings, and to reclaim its pride of place in the world and to dominate once again, to become great once again in the eyes of Allah, who will then bestow upon the Muslim people his blessings, that they must fight the infidel. So that's that ideology. Now, you would think that the social justice warriors in the United States and the West would take one look at this radical Islamist ideology that is anti-gay, that's anti-women, anti-everything that they believe in, and say, those guys are the bad guys. But you would be wrong if you thought that, because they look at those people and they say, well, they're the colonized. And the colonized have absolutely no agency. They're, nothing that they think or do really matters because they've been subjugated by the colonizer. So when they hear that, you know, gay Palestinians have been thrown off the rooftops in Gaza, they don't say, oh, that's an oppressive state. They say, no, they're colonized, and therefore they're deprived of their free will. And the first order of business is to give them power and to disempower the people who are doing it. And then we'll worry about those other issues. But right now, they're not responsible for themselves.
Yeah. And for those who are listening who don't have like a really strong understanding of these concepts, if this sounds like a vast contortion of reality, requiring like the Olympic caliber mental gymnastics that it takes to wrap your head around it, it's because it is. This is such a contorted reality. What is now seen as progressive and liberal is honestly regressive and as illiberal, I think, as anything on earth today.
Absolutely.
So, okay, let me preface my next statement by saying that I have never been accused of being an optimist when it comes to the rise of anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. I embody what I would term a realistic and healthy pessimism that is roundly frowned upon in the face of what I see as a dangerous level of Western Jewish optimism and complacency. Granted, I live in the epicenter of intersectional wokeism, so it may just be hard for me to see the forest through the trees, or the trees through the forest. How does that go? So I live in Brentwood on LA's notoriously left-wing west side, perhaps the most left-leaning district in America. It maybe barring something in San Francisco. I'm deeply ensconced in the love and light world of yoga. And I also used to be proud to be an Ivy League grad. So no matter where I turn, it seems there is more anti-Semitic vitriol and rage around every single corner. And as far as I'm concerned, this war should not be regarded as a two-sided argument. It's a slippery slope when we normalize the debate of good versus evil. So, David, you are a strong advocate for free speech, and I'd like to dig into that just a little bit.
Sure.
So, first, when fighting for dichotomous free speech on the Israel-Palestinian conflict in general and the Israel-Hamas war in particular, isn't that creating the same dangerous equivalency as the ICJ did with Netanyahu and Sinwar and by also like equating anti-Semitism with Islamophobia?
So I'm not equating anybody with anybody by supporting free speech. I'm saying free speech is an opportunity for society to openly discuss questions, to debate, and that is the operating system of a healthy society, allows people free speech. It allows different points of view to come to the surface. We realize that some things are just gross, and beyond the pale, denying the Holocaust or saying that, slavery should have never ended or something like that, outrageous like that. But in a healthy society, we have a pretty large Overton window. We want people to be able to talk about issues, because the opposite of that is to stifle free expression of ideas, and that usually empowers a bad guy in the process. And in this case, in the environments that you're part of, that I'm part of to a degree, are th those bad guys are leftist totalitarians who are dictating what can be said, what is acceptable, and what's not. And that is not healthy. And so I think when we're talking about restoring free speech, we're not saying that everybody's opinion is equally valid. We're saying that the best we can do as a society is to have an open society that allows people with different views to debate each other in an open way. And that stifling that, as you see on many of these college campuses, I think I might have said this last time I was on, if you want to understand how free speech intersects with the radicalism and the extremism we've seen on college, look at the colleges where it's worse and where free speech is at its lowest point. How do we know where it's at its lowest point? The organization FIRE does an annual survey, and the three worst colleges on free speech are Columbia, Harvard, and Penn. They're the
Oh,
most
wow.
intellectually stifling environments of any college in the country, and they're also the places where there was the most anti-Israel and anti-Jewish extremism. That's because an ideological camp has taken over that campus and said, we're the ones that get to decide what's true here. And if you don't follow us, then you're on the outs. Then you're an oppressor. So I think that look, free speech does not solve all of our problems, okay? And I'm sure there are people who will there are anti-Semites who will use it as a platform, but they already have a platform. They don't require, in fact, they're the ones that are taking advantage of the stifling intellectual environment. They're the ones who are saying, we're the ones that get to say what's right and what who has speech. So I think we should, so the, our answer, the free speech is not our problem, it's our solution. Is restoring that in what a true liberal environment. A true liberal environment allows people with different opinions to talk to each other and talk and disagree with each other.
And at face value, I actually 100% agree with you. But look what happened with X. We didn't wind up with a kinder, gentler, even more fact-based narrative, but in fact, exactly the opposite. I mean, isn't this like trajectory anathema to our actual goals of educating the uneducated and miseducated? Because when we advocate for free speech, it's under the pretense that that's going to allow our voices to be heard, but it goes both ways, which means the other side, which is bigger, badder, 97 or more percent of these faculties, is going to get louder, and they are going to be empowered to embrace more lies and more propaganda. So I would say that if free speech only meant we get to be heard, terrific. But I'm afraid that this is going to amplify the other side as well.
Do you think the other side is lacking in their ability to speak? I mean, you know, it seems like they have a pretty big platform as it is. I mean, they don't need free speech to have free speech. They're out there. They're dominating the narrative. You know, it's not like you're not okay. Let's not have free speech. We're going to shut them down. They're out there. They have a platform. They're taking full advantage of their free speech. They've used the environment in the academy to stifle our voice. Okay. They've used it to stifle our voice. You make a very good point about X and about social media, and social media didn't quite work out the way that we thought. It didn't just create free speech. It created sort of ideological bubbles where people could organize and just hear themselves or echoes of themselves and others. And it reinforced ideological prejudices. I don't have an easy answer to that. I don't, you know, when people say, well, then let's stop the free speech on X, let's moderate this in a more way, let's aggressively intervene. What you end up doing is empowering a bunch of 23-year-old Yale graduates who are the censors now that have been hired by X or Instagram or Facebook, whoever else. And they don't just, they empower the people you don't want them to empower. And they and then they use it as an opportunity to shut down discussions on important topics like gender or racism, and treat anything that diverges from their consensus view as being racist or bigoted. So again, the stifling of free speech ain't working out well for us. And I'm saying, look, I don't have all the answers, and free speech doesn't solve everything. But I do know this, that when campuses were less ideologically charged, less stifling, more open to alternative ideas, they were better places for our students, Jewish students, than they are today. And that's why I would much rather go back, not that we could ever go back to the past exactly, but go back to a place where there was a much healthier free exchange of ideas, because I think that's the best we can do.
Okay. Normally I would believe in freedom of speech to the extent that intellectual discourse should not be censored, but to the extent that it's actually embroiling these campuses in such an anti-Semitic rage, I do believe that they're
not free places. That's the
I
point.
Know. Sure.
They're places that lack free speech.
Right.
They're places that are favoring certain perspectives over other perspectives. Okay. It's favored speech. It's not free speech.
Yeah. Okay. So I hear this argument all the time from the Jewish camp. Is like, you know, we need to hear both sides. You need to hear our side. You need to understand there's two sides, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's just the issue that the anti-Israel camp has absolutely no interest in, as you said, in any sort of unbiased approach that teaches both sides of the conflict. So it's like we take such pains to be egalitarian, right? Remember during Black Lives Matter, the worst thing that you could say was all lives matter. Like that was like the worst thing you could say. It proved
right.
that you were right. A bigot. But I feel like we, our efforts of egalitarianism become like pretty much cannibalistic. It feels like as Jews, we're now undermining ourselves with our own determined Tikkun Olamism.
Right.
And so
I think you're conflating a few different things. Look, if there is no free speech on campus, it is not the bad guys that are going to be shut down. It is us who are going to be shut down. That is what's happening. Okay. Yeah. You can say, I'm not for free speech because I want the Hamasniks to shut up.
Yeah.
That is not what will happen. The campus is dominated by people who agree with the Hamasniks, not us. It will be if there's no free speech, it is we who will be shut down. Okay,
But
it
then
is our voices that will be considered marginal, not the other side, because we are the minority voice. So free speech always empowers the minority voice. They're the dominant voice on campuses. This deck is stacked against us. The professors are something like 98% lefty. I mean, the statistics are unbelievable. So it's not like so the problem is that our positions are being stifled, not their positions. And you can say, well, let's start stifling their positions. That ain't gonna happen. And it will and you do that and you power somebody to stifle the positions, that is a tool that will be used against you.
I 100% understand what you're saying, but within the argument is also the problem. Let's take it to the right instead of the left. If we have professors that suddenly become the dominant voice because they want to teach courses on Nazism and Holocaust denial,
Right.
we say no, let us also teach a course that the Holocaust did happen, or do we say that supporting terror, supporting Nazism, just like, I mean, we would never have a class on, on anti-Black, anti-gay, anti-trans, anti-minority, anti-women, anti, like
Right.
it just wouldn't exist. So I 100% understand what you're saying, but the problem is also within your actual response.
Right. But see, there are the Overton window is not an unlimited, you don't say the N-word, for example. That is demeaning rhetoric, right? We're not that is and we know that there are limits. So free speech doesn't mean anything goes at any time. First of all, of course, denying the Holocaust or preaches Nazism is not scholarly. It doesn't adhere to scholarly norms. There now does do a lot of the gender studies classes or the radical ethnic studies classes adhere to scholarly norms? No, but they're the postmodernist theory behind them. There's a case for it. Like you can make an argument about it. You can make an argument of Palestinian oppression if you want. Now, do I think that there's a place on a campus for a course that teaches that all that Jews are genocidal murders? No, but that's and again, I yes. So there's certain kinds of speech that cross the line at the most extreme end that just aren't appropriate for the syllabus of a university. Now, if a group of students is marching on the campus quad and they're not trying to shout down a Hillel right across the street, and they're not disrupting my child from walking from their dorm to their class, and they're just saying from the river to the sea, all Palestine will be free. Am I going to try to shut that down? First of all, I think it would violate the First Amendment in most cases, and I don't want the First Amendment. I don't want to violate the First Amendment. So to me, that's not our problem. If that was the only thing that was happening, is a group of 100 students, 200 students were going around yelling out this chant, we'd be okay. What's happened is much more nefarious than that. What's happened is that a group of radicals among professors and students have taken over the campus square and tried to shut us out. Okay, so the problem is not that a group of students can say something we don't like that we regard as radical. The problem is it's been empowered at the highest levels, and that we have to oppose.
100%. Okay, so woke anti-Semitism is here.
It's here. It's here. Let's
The question is, and it seems like you've answered it, like, is it here to stay? So we know that this phenomenon is a function of intersectionality, as you have so clearly explained. We also know that our education system, everybody outside of this argument, only sees the college campuses, but we're talking preschool to grad school here, has been complicit in this dangerous social programming. Some from the educators themselves, I got an email today from the ADL saying that 25% of the college students who were in a particular survey said that they received anti-Semitic rhetoric from their professors. 25%, that is frightening. That is indoctrination. So some of this is coming from the educators themselves. Some are coming from the student groups. that are both sanctioned and often celebrated with burritos and pizza by university administrations. So Students for Justice in Palestine immediately comes to mind. It's three lies in one name. The students are the Muslim Brotherhood. The justice is the annihilation of the Jewish state. And Palestine is the Jewish state. So let me just zero in on this for 1 second, because I think that they have played an outsized role in this conflict. How significant of a role do you think SJP has played in the college campus crisis that we've been facing in the last few years?
It's a good question, but I'm going to take a step back and then I'm going to pivot to the question. You know, the question about how much of an optimist or pessimist we should be, you know, it's a hard question for me to answer. I'm sort of a natural optimist. I really am. Like, I think, you know, my wife sometimes gets mad at me when I'm like, oh, it'll all work out. And she's like, how do you know it's all going to work out? So, because it's all going to work out. You know, I'm reminded of the time not that many decades ago when there are neighborhoods that had restricted covenants where you and I couldn't live in, right? And there were clubs that we could never be part of. They still might be a little wary of us in some of those clubs, but most of them, you know, there might be 30% Jews now, places where Jews weren't allowed to go golfing years ago, right? There are medical practices and law practices that would not have Jews, and Jews created their own legal practices, and now those places are largely integrated. Things can get better, and I imagine that if we were Jews in the 40s and 50s looking at those high walls and those obstacles, it would seem almost insurmountable. And now we're looking back and say, okay, that was then. And things can get better, and they do change. And culture changes as well. So SJP, look, I mean, you know, a lot of times it's hard to boil down something like this to one or two things. It's usually like a complex array of factors, right? And if you know, there's this, let's call it Muslim Brotherhood, whether it's SJP or Americans for Muslim for Palestine, which I think is SJP's main sponsor, you know, and Qatar and the money that they give these organizations that give them the lifeblood that they need to thrive on campus. You have that, or you could go then to the students who come from the Arab world and other places, but a lot from the Arab world, from rich families who are then some of the main activists on campus. You know, you can look, of course, at the radical ideology that has been traveling through our campuses and dominated the way people think. All of those are factors. It's hard to sort them out from each other. I could even cite more, you know, you look at the sort of institutionalization of DEI and radical DEI in some universities that teach kids who the oppressors are and who the oppressed are and the like. All of these things are sort of happening and bubbling up at once, and they are mutually reinforcing. I think SJP is part of a radicalized Muslim Brotherhood network in the United States. I think we know less about it than we should, because it falls under organizations that call themselves religious and therefore don't have to disclose all their information. That, I believe, is going to be changed because there's discovery being done in University of Virginia, and now they're going to be able to look in those documents, and so they're not going to enjoy that immunity that from scrutiny that they once did. If the SJP is actively involved with trying to stop Jewish students and others from going to their classes, if they're involved in illegal activity like shouting down at Hillel on Friday night, and we've seen examples of that, they're engaging in illegal activity, in activity that violates school policies, they should be shut down. I mean, no question about it. There are some SJP chapters that haven't been quite as aggressive. And if they're on their campuses and, you know, they're, you know, organizing their programs or whatever, you know, fine. You know, but I think in a lot of places, that's not the case. And what they've done is they've managed to insinuate themselves into sort of the progressive politics of campus and become the a lead. So a lot of these protesters, you'll see a lot of, you know, non-Muslim students involved and so forth, the larger progressive community. And the leaders of that are these SJP activists. You know, look, we have a new administration. It's shock. I know you know that. And that administration is saying that it's going to deport foreign students who violate the law and violate university policies. Will that, there's will it be held up in court? We don't know. There's no guarantee that will all happen. There's a bunch of executive orders. We just don't know if they're gonna withstand scrutiny. I do think, look, if a foreign student comes here and engages in extremist activities, they support organizations that are on the State Department list of banned terrorist organizations, that I think we have every right to say it's time for you to get back on a flight to your home country. And I will absolutely support that. And I will absolutely support a university shutting down an SJP chapter that is either engaging in violence or disruptive activity.
I agree with you. And I do want to also, going back to your book, a point that you made is that though most of us became most aware of this in around the mid-90s, or some of us even just now, you point out in your book that the woke movement really started in academia 50 years ago with postmodernism. Then, as we said, like SJP was founded actually in 1993. They took that ball and like not just ran, okay, they sprinted with that ball. Now, their whole strategy was to implant violent anti-Israel ideology and rhetoric into Western society by cloaking it in feigned social justice. They actually started laying their groundwork in the mid-90s by creating alliances with every possible minority group. This is how they rose to the cream of the crop, because they waited over a decade to ask their equally oppressed compadres for one teeny tiny favor. And that was to support justice against the genocidal apartheid
BBS.
state of Israel. Yes, but under the pretense, again, of justice against this horrible, horrible enemy. Then, of course, came woke baby of the 2020s, and the indoctrination was complete. Jihadis and Jew haters have inextricably co-opted the left, and it's been shown that a large percentage of these intersectional allies know a grand total of absolutely nothing about Israel or the war with Hamas. So, what does this say about the next generation's desperation to find meaning, their complete disinterest in seeking out facts, and their blind willingness to immerse themselves in rabid hatred?
Yeah, it's very funny. I was speaking to a young man who's around 30, pro-Israel, actually wrote a book. His name's Dmitry Shafutinsky, wrote a book called Jiu-Jitsu, like JEW Jiu-Jitsu. And I said to him, I said, it's public, so I can say this. I said, "So Dmitry, you're 30 years old." He said, "Yeah." I said, "You're Gen Z." He goes, No, I'm a millennium." I said, "Oh, so you hate Gen Z as well?" He goes, "Yeah, I do." Look, I have Gen Z kids. They're lovely people. I just sat with this college couple in Washington. They're both tremendous pro-Israel activists and writers and thinkers. And I thought, wow, if these kids are in charge in 25 years, we'll all be better off. So there's a lot of amazing young people who, by the way, whose sensibilities and views were forged in response to the sort of woke onslaught on their campuses. And these are the people who stood up to it. So there's some great young people out there. That there were some very varying worrying statistics after October 7th that we've all seen, that the Harris poll, Harvard Harris poll, showed that about that something like 50-50 of young people between ages 18 and 24 supported Hamas. And that was really disturbing. And you could, if you looked at that in the larger context of other age groups, it was really strange. I mean, most Americans, by to the tune of 80% to 20%, supported Israel. And here we had this young generation of 18, 24-year-olds. Okay, that is a good argument for your brand of pessimism. Now, the latest poll that came out, maybe this challenges your thesis a little bit, I warn you. It, just like this last few days, was that somehow Their opinion now aligns. So, and by the way, that was not just one poll, Harvard-Harris poll. There were multiple Harvard-Harris polls over the course of very many months that
Sure.
showed that that was their opinion. And one just came out showing something like 71 to 29% of college students or 18 to 24-year-old age brackets support Israel. This is the latest one, the same poll, the same questions that have been asked. So I'm interested in seeing more data on this. I'm not going to go and throw my party yet, but it
Right.
does seem like there's been some mysterious shift, and we'll have to learn more. How far gone is this generation? I don't know because I, based on that last poll, people do change. Like, there were the boomer generation was kind of radical during the 1960s, and then they got jobs and whatever, and they changed. Do I think that this generation can change? I think it can. Do I worry that it won't change, that it'll be stuck in this sort of radical ideology as it becomes more and more powerful? I think we've seen that, by the way. I think we've seen younger people graduate from college with these views and go into the workplace and literally take over their institutions and install the oppressor-oppressor ideology. We saw this in some of the wars at the New York Times, for example, with young reporters insisting that certain people be fired and the like. We saw this at places like the ACLU, which was a different, totally different organization 10, 20 years ago, being taken over by a bunch of young activists who wouldn't could not bear to hear an opinion that they didn't like. So I do think that there's some worrying signs. I think that that latest poll gave me a glimmer of hope. And I think the jury's still out on what's going to happen. But we have a lot of work to do. I worry about their younger brothers and sisters. This went from being mostly a college problem to now a K through 12 problem. And my organization, the Jewish Institute for Liberal Values, which is going to become, as of Monday, the North American Values Institute, we're going through a rebrand and solely dedicated to fighting the good fight on K through 12 education. We're worried that, a generation of activist teachers is indoctrinating our kids, not just in anti-Semitic views, which they are, but in anti-American and anti-Western views. And it is frightening. I have a colleague of mine, Marcy Goldstein, who is doing research right now on what's called decolonizing the curriculum. She's a yoga person, by the way, huge yoga person. She teaches Sanskrit and everything. She's a huge yoga person. She's doing research on decolonizing the curriculum or decolonizing the syllabi. And what does that mean? It means stripping out all the Western influences in the curriculum and teaching people this oppressed oppressor ideology. That's what decolonizing the curriculum means. And a whole generation of teachers has been brought up in this ideological pedagogical format. And they're now bringing it to the classroom and think that they have an absolute unmitigated right to do so. And so that is, to me, one of the biggest challenges we face, not just about the kids who are now in college and maybe they'll grow up, I don't know, but the another generation of young people who are being exposed to it at a much earlier age.
A lot to unpack here. Let me just say that with going back to the first thing you said about the promising young grads, we saw with the election of Trump and this big red wave that, yes, when we see this radical extremism, there is sometimes a boomerang effect where people are like, oh, no. That when you light shine a light on darkness, then the darkness disappears. So I appreciate that. Beyond that, here is the difference between your optimism and my, what I call realism, but what most people call pessimism is you see the glass as 70% full and I see it as 30% empty. I think the fact that 30% of college students support terrorists is a real problem. And I want to talk a little bit later about this dynamic, but going into what you're saying about the next generation, and again, that's why I said, like, we've got the people from 50 years ago, we've got the SJP generation, then we've got the woke baby generation. So it basically takes two generations to reprogram a society, right? Because you've got the kids and you got the parents reinforcing what the kids are saying. But once you hit three generations, which is where we're heading now, there's a tipping point where anti-Semitism becomes like truly entrenched in society. People across the globe are choosing sides in this literal war of good versus evil. And it genuinely scares me how many are choosing evil, even if it's only 30%. That's a lot. Now, no offense, but I would love to see your book relegated to distant historical memory someday. I don't see that happening. How can Western society be deprogrammed after kids, parents, and grandparents have all been radicalized and the education system has proven that it has no desire to change?
Yeah, well, hopefully we can change it. You know, the power of parents to reclaim their schools. I mean, I think that there's a lot of power there, a lot of parents merging, saying we are not going to put up with that. We may still be in the early stages of a very long battle with the school systems and with ideological teachers. And I'm not convinced that they're going to be able to stave us off for that long. This is the optimist in me talking. I do believe that fighting back works. Not always, not all the time, not in the way we wanted to, not in the timeline we always wanted to, but it can work. And that's why, that gives me hope. I think that if you look back, the Gallup poll has been doing polls on Israel and the Palestinians for something like 25 years. And you can see, and actually it was really the high point of support for Israel was like 2013, 2014, where something like, 68% of Americans thought that Israel generally supported Israel, and something like 15% supported the Palestinians.
Can I just interject something really quickly?
Yeah.
Because 2013-14 is important. 2014 was Operation Protective Edge. Okay, that was the tipping point where social media had entrenched, right? Coleman Hughes talks about this, about how the opinions of Black oppression skyrocketed in that same exact year. This isn't a coincidence.
No doubt. I write about it in my book, by the way. I was heading up a pro-Israel campus organization, and I literally, from one school year to the next, had seen a tremendous shift in attitude on campus. I mean, it was palpable. Some of the students that we had been working with that were pro-Israel had become anti-Israel overnight. So you could really feel that. But I'm saying, and it might have been more like 2012, I have to look back at it, but I'm saying that there was a high point of support for Israel around that time. And it's not that it actually, if you look at the line, it's not that the line starts to decline. What you start to see is that Republicans in the right become more and more pro-Israel, and the left becomes less and less pro-Israel, the Democrats. And that trajectory continues. But what we saw during that time, particularly 2013 to 2020, was a much more precipitous decline among a very specific age group, which are young people. Mm-hmm. And that really scared us. And we started to say, feel that they may be beyond reach right now, that a lot of the communications efforts, and there was some serious polling and surveying done, were saying that, college students were still up for grabs. Not all of them, but a high percentage of them were still up for grabs. But as 2013 became 2015, that became 2020, fewer and fewer college students seemed to be, according to the data that we were seeing, up for grabs. And so we started to think, well, maybe good messaging is not going to work. Why isn't good messaging working anymore? Why is it that a view that was confined to, let's say, 20% of campus, this sort of Israel's an apartheid state, now somehow a more dominant view? And I think what happened is that's when the woke revolution hit. And that's when people were conditioning students to think in these binaries. And that made them much more susceptible to thinking that Israel had to be the bad guy and the Palestinians had to be good guys. That's how we're dividing up the campus. That's how we're dividing up the world. And that's when things started to go down. Again, can that change? I don't know. I think we have our work cut out for us. Let's put it that way.
I'll tell you, as somebody who's been a pro-Israel activist for decades, 2014 was the first year that we started seeing counter-protesters at the pro-Israel rallies here in Los Angeles. So
Sure.
I remember that very, very clearly. Before there might have been a dozen across the street, and there would be hundreds of us, if not thousands of us. That was when the tipping point changed. And now, I mean, it's completely reversed.
Yeah.
So let's get to the actual premise that I presented you with originally when I contacted you. We're closing in on an hour here. Are you okay continuing for
Yeah,
a
sure.
long, 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 long time?
Let's get into it.
Okay. So these kids, the 30%, love it or leave it, just spent 16 months shrieking, ceasefire now, and then the ceasefire is now. You would think in a logical world that this would greatly please and appease them, that they would cry for glee for peace from the river to the sea. But no. Instead, they've actually doubled down on their violent anti-Semitic intimidation and threats, not just in America. Again, we're talking globally. They're calling for more jihad, more death to the Jews, and they've instigated another spike in anti-Semitic incidents. With the ceasefire now in effect and the possible end of the war in sight, it's been my long-held belief that far from woke anti-Semitism receding into the annals of history, their voice will only continue to rise in a morally irreconcilable inverse relationship to the winding down of the war in Gaza. I'm wondering if you agree or disagree with this thesis.
I'm gonna say the jury's still out on it. I think that there's evidence going both ways. Look, globally is one, the global perspective is one, the US perspective is another. I worry that the Jews in Canada, for example, where they're badly outnumbered, where the demographic lines are going in the opposite direction, where there's a very, very robust anti-Israel voice that it can dominate and shut them down, that they're more in trouble in the long run. And I think the same can be said for Europe.
And Australia, my goodness. Australia
And
worse.
Australia as well, very similar to Europe. The United States is a different ball of wax in many ways. And I'm more optimistic. I'm not saying that it will turn out this way, but I think I'm more optimistic. First of all, look, I think that you're I think that there are fewer encampments this year than there were last year. There's not, there's there, it's not, this is not the spring of 2024. I mean, it's just not. Like, there's still a lot of nasty and violent campus activism and professors shutting down students and the rest, but you're not seeing the same thing as you were last spring.
But why? It's not because they don't want to. It's because they're not allowed to anymore.
Well, okay, maybe a little bit of both. Maybe that some of the Maybe some of the energy behind the movement has died down. That was the fad of the time. I'm not saying the fad is completely not upon us, and I'm not saying by any means that woke anti-Semitism is not a problem. What I would argue is that what's happening in the larger society is that wokeism has sort of reached a tipping point where it's on the decline in the larger society. But what's happening in institutions where it's the strongest, they're doubling down. So if you look at, like, if you're a K through 12 ideological teacher who wants to indoctrinate your kids and politicize your kids, right, in your way of looking at the world, and you're seeing what's happening in the rest of society in this sort of anti-woke backlash and the anti-DEI backlash, you're going to do everything you can to get your view locked into the curriculum. So you're going to work extra hard now because you know that your days may be numbered and you want to institutionalize it as much as possible. That is what is happening in my view. So if your kids are in a K through 12 system, it may be worse this year than last year because those ideological teachers are working overtime to get themselves, ingrained into the system.
Just like Iran running for the bomb.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's get it
Exactly.
done before Trump stops it.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that's what's happening right now. And so we're not out of the woods by any means. I think what's happened is that they've been exposed to being much more of a minority than they pretended to be. In other words, this is what this ideology does, is it makes a small group of people loom large. It makes a small group of ideologues. Even the 30%, by the way, in that poll, doesn't mean that all those 30% of college students really support Hamas. They're given a binary choice on a survey, and they say, who do you support more? And when they say Hamas, they're not thinking about these guys with the green headbands and the black faces. They're thinking about, some are supporting Hamas. I mean, and some are probably just saying, well, I think that the Israelis are being mean and the Palestinians are nicer and they're victims or whatever. So not all of them are Hamasniks. Too many are. So to me, that poll is good news. I mean, would I rather 30% support, Hamas or 50%? I'd rather 30, and I'd rather know that we're part of the 70%. So we can't take good trends and say they're bad trends. We can still say they're not good enough, but a trend is a trend, and that is a trend. At least it's
trend. I'm also looking at a data point, and you're looking at a trend. So you're right that perhaps the trend is moving in the right direction. The data point scares me.
Look, we could, if we don't get control of what's happening in K-12, especially and campuses, and this continues on, and too many school administrators just give in to the radical ideologues, and the teachers' unions throw around their weight, and we just say, well, we'll just try to get anti-Semitism covered in DEI so that they'll be nicer to the Jews, which never works anywhere. We're going to really be facing a long-term problem, and there will be a diminution, and it will get worse in a real sense. And so I don't want to declare victory by any means. We have a lot of work to do, and there's no guarantee that we'll win even if we do everything right, because, you know, these are some very powerful forces that have been allowed to run roughshod over society for a long time, while very well-meaning people, some of them a little center left, some of them a little center right, sat around and said, you know what, I don't want to take these people on. They're kind of nasty and they're going to call me names. There's that old saying, never wrestle with a pig because you'll get dirty and the pig likes it. So moderates, well-meaning moderates, the people who take their kids to, you know, hockey practice or whatever every day and have other things to do, they don't want to get dirty. And so they stay out of it. And what does that do? It puts the pig in charge.
And right.
And so we've allowed that to happen for a long time. And now we've got to go back and try to fight those forces off and put them back into their place, because they're not as many as they seem, but they've had outsized power. That to me is our fundamental challenge. And there's no guarantee we'll be able to overcome that. It's a huge challenge. They really have accumulated a lot of power in particular institutions. And those institutions are the key cultural institutions, the places that we learn reading and writing, that we practice reading and writing. These are scientific journals. These are medical associations and legal associations. And so they have tremendous cultural power. And so there's no guarantee that just because we've reached a tipping point at society at large, and that's showing up in elections and the like, that that's going to be translated into victories within these institutional settings that are super important. So we have our work cut out for us. I do think the trend lines are in our favor, but who knows, you know? And that means that we've got to build the majority voice. And this is really where I think our strategy has to shift.
Mm-hmm.
Our strategy is that it's not about getting people to understand and fight against anti-Semitism. It's about understanding that these radical forces are deeply anti-American. So our allies are not the people who agree with us. They're the people who align with us. It might be a veterans group that says, I don't want people hoisting a Palestinian flag in the middle of campus. That's it. Take down the American flag. How dare they? Those are our allies. Or it might be an Indian American who's upset that they're closing down the magnet school. They're not thinking about anti-Semitism. They like us. They want to be us. You know, you guys Jews have succeeded so much. How do we do that? But they're not concerned about anti-Semitism. They're concerned about the magnet school. They're our allies.
Shared values.
Right. Shared values. Shared American Western liberal values. And
it's
that's what we...
positive intersectionality.
Yes. Our own form
Reductive
of intersectionality.
Intersectionality.
Right. Yes, exactly. That's what I think we've got to affect in society. You know, when I don't know. I hope I didn't say this on the last podcast. My when Betty White died, my wife started to watch all of the old episodes of The Golden Girls. And I don't watch it. I sit, but I'm sitting next to her in bed and she's watching it on her smartphone, you know. And I'm listening to this dialogue between Bea Arthur, the Dorothy, and her mother,
Estelle
Estelle. Exactly. And it was hilarious as it always was. And she said, and at one point, Dorothy started to lecture her mom. She said, "Mom, you were the one that put the American flag in my hand. You were the one that told me about this country and what it stands for." And it was this beautiful patriotic tribute. And I was thinking, it stopped me in my tracks. Why? Because this was a very liberal show in the 1980s, a very liberal vanguard show. And you would never hear such a show today express such sentiment. And I thought to myself, that shows you in a nutshell how things have changed. And what we've got to get back is sort of, we got to get moderates and liberals to retake and re-own their own narrative about this country and about the West and about the values that they stand up for. And that will be a bulwark against anti-Semitism.
Yes.
And I think that in that is our advocacy. In that are our new alliances. In that is our optimism.
Okay. I like that you ended with the word optimism because I heard a little bit of Shauna pessimism in there.
There
But
was, well, I decry what happened. I decry what happened. Like what we allowed to happen. And you know, us nice, I mean, I'm a Gen Xer. I don't know if you are. You might
Yeah, I think we're about the same age. I'm
you probably
53.
say, how old are you?
53.
I'm 58. So I'm on the, you know, we're both Gen Xers. I'm a, you know, a few more years I'd be a boomer, but I'm a Gen Xer. And, you know, we were very, we didn't stand up for these core values in the way we should. And we allowed the discourse to get away from us. And now we created a generation of people who don't respect those ideals anymore. So, yeah, is that pessimistic? Well, that's realistic. That's what happened. But my optimism is we can reclaim this and we must reclaim it.
I hope we do, because one of the other points you make in your book is that California is whatever happens in California will happen in the rest of the country a few years later. Speaking from California, believe me, the trajectory will not be a good one.
Absolutely.
It's very dangerous. I have not just kids, but parents who many who have quit classes with me because I support Israel, for example, or have made a lot of painfully woke comments that are just very counterproductive. I don't know what else to call it, but anyway, getting back to the concept of entrenching in anti-Semitism, again, it seems like you're saying somewhere between 2012 and 2014. I personally would say 2014, but whatever it was, there was something that shifted. But what I've seen with the anti-Israel activists is that particularly since then, they have been systematically keeping the anti-Semitic rhetoric alive, even during times of relative calm on social media. And this is always, calm is always relative, of course. So as to prevent the flame from burning out and to set the stage for the next conflagration, which was 10/7. So let's be honest, woke anti-Semitism did not start with the war. So why would it end with it? This war was just a force multiplier. And I want to show a graph. These are the US anti-Semitic hate crime stats. Hold on one sec. Let me share my screen for one moment. Hello, hold on, sorry. Share. Oh, grr. Ah, there we go. There we go. Okay. So this is the ADL's graph of anti-Semitic incidents in America. You can see in the bottom that they define it as anti-Jewish vandalism, harassment, and assault reported detected by ADL. I'm gonna have to move this so you can even see the top of this graph. But the point that I want to make, if we're talking trend lines, if you're talking about this is more or less a flat trend line, right? There's always going to be vicissitudes, but it's more or less flat. Now, obviously, so here we have 2020, right? This is the BLM, this is pandemic, and things start to move in the wrong direction. Now, here's the real point I want to make. And please, audience, keep in mind that this is 2023, okay? Which means that not only did this spike, which more than doubled in anti-Semitism, occur in 2023, but keep in mind that most of the spike was accounted for after the most violent massacre of Jews since World War II, first of all, and second of all, that occurred in October. So most of this spike is going to be accounted for by just 3 months. Now, the 2024 statistics, I couldn't find a graph that actually graphed it, but it's more than three times this number. Okay, so this, I forget it, it's not even going to fit on my screen. There's no way to like graph that on my screen right now. We're talking a 300% increase or more in 2024. Okay, I'm going to stop sharing. Sorry, let's go back to the point I was making, if I could remember what it was. Okay, so here's the thing is that I, looking at this graph and at these numbers, I actually personally do not believe this is simply a moment in time, but the start of a very possibly long and dark era. And one thing that radical Islam has over the rest of the world is insane patience. Their long games take decades or generations or even centuries to play out. Now that they've won the battle of normalizing anti-Semitism, I fear that this was their ultimate intention all along, that far beyond simply undermining and destroying the Jewish state, war-related anti-Zionism was nothing more than a clever pretense for unleashing the tidal wave of Jew hatred that has flooded the entire world. So I'm wondering, do you agree? I think, do you agree that there is a sinister strategy at play here, or do you think this is just this generation's Vietnam?
I think there are sinister actors that are of a sinister strategy, and I think some of it is just an ideological moment in our country. And you've created sort of a perfect storm, probably in the spring of 2024. Do I think the 2025 numbers will be worse or better? I think they'll probably look a little bit better because we had such a raucous moment in the spring of 2024. I mean, just I know you're in the LA area. You've watched what happened at UCLA. Really appalling, you know. So we had a very scary period in the spring of 2024. Look, I, you know, that it could be that we're on your trajectory. Absolutely could be. You know, I'm involved in some war game scenarios about the future, and there's this sort of dystopian one of 2048 that we're going to contend with, in which, you know, Jews have become systematically disenfranchised in this country, that we're that, and you know, it would follow the worst of the trend lines we're seeing now. And is that a possible scenario? Absolutely. Do I think it's inevitable? No. Do I think it's the most probable one? I don't, but I worry that it could still happen. You know, it's again, I mean, I can't see the through a crystal ball. I think the United States is a remarkably amazing country, capable of renewal, like unlike any other society in the world. And I have more faith that this country will find its center of gravity and that it will hold these radical voices at bay. We're in a very tumultuous period. There's rampant political polarization. In polarization, you find conspiracy theories, and in conspiracy theories, you find anti-Semitism. And so I think it's not a it's not so the trend lines in that environment are not in our favor, but I do think America is likely to find its center of gravity, that there are forces moving in the opposite direction of that. Well, you know, look, I mean, you know, okay, when I was at the David Project in 2010 to 2015, and I saw these trends play out on campuses, I remember there was one year, might have been 2011, when Abu Nima, who was the head of the Electronic Intifada and the primary organizer of BDS, was away from the U.S. campus scene. He had a fellowship somewhere abroad, and the entire environment settled during that year. There was very little BDS in that year, and it showed you that one person could just create a tremendous shitstorm, and that's what he managed to do. Now, you know, look, if there's a bunch of if a bunch of students from the Arab world who have been fomenting all this now fear that they're going to be deported if they do so, or some of them are actually deported, might that change the campus atmosphere all of a sudden? You know, I don't know. Might some of these lawsuits and investigations lead to the disenfranchisement of SJP? Might Qatar, worried about its the scorn of a new administration, start to cut back on its funding of radicals? Like, all those things are possible. Look, Saudi Arabia was the primary funder of all this. If you went back to 9/11, and I used to do a lot of research in this area, Saudi Arabia was funding all these programs and decided that that it was too risky for them, and they changed their strategy. Mm-hmm. And so Qatar took their place. So again, things do change, and they change for the worse and they change for the better. And so I don't think you can just look at the trend lines on a graph like that and say that's going to just keep on going up and up and up. I don't think it will, but it's possible that it will. And that's why I think we have to maintain some agency ourselves and say, how are we going to fight back against this? What are we going to do to catalyze a counter movement against these ideological changes? How are we going to make sure that Qatar doesn't continue to fund these academic trends and these radicals on campus and these radical organizations? Again, we you know, it was partly the Jewish pushback against that in 2001, 2002, 2003 that put Saudi Arabia on its back foot and made them reconsider. So why not again?
Well, when it comes to Qatar, let me ask a question, because I guess my understanding of academia isn't as complete as I'd like it to be. How does the tenure system, like, so let's say Qatar tomorrow is like, okay, I'm going to take the $7 billion. I'm going to stop there. No more money to all these, you know, Ivy League schools, but we already put all these professors and all of this curriculum into the schools. They're entrenched. They have tenure. What recourse is there given the tenure system? Because I don't fully understand it.
Yeah, look, it will take a while to work some of that out of the system, but it's not the only thing happening. So if a bunch of Jewish donors, or not just Jewish donors, but donors and trustees of universities say enough is enough, and they start pushing back, and they put pressure on university presidents not to empower these professors and, you know, and to and give them, you know, louder microphones than they would have otherwise had, I think, again, you can change the dynamic. It's not going to happen overnight. This is a generational challenge we're talking about. But I think it, you know, also, by the way, that money doesn't just ensconce people in universities. It creates an incentive structure for people like that. So if you want to get the next round of Qatari funding, you're going to be, you know, a loudmouth academic. So once you take that away, that's going to damper the enthusiasm of some of these academics who are not going to be able to, you know, vie for Qatari money. So it changes the dynamic. Again, it's going to take none of these things happen alone. This is multifactorial. So just as the problem is multifactorial, the solution has to be multifactorial. So we have to hit the system coming from different angles and in different ways so that it starts to retract. And I think that's possible, but it's not going to happen overnight. And some of the things that we all want to do, like just lash out or just shut down this or that group, none of them are going to be the one size fits all solution or and deliver us from this. It's got to be structural change over time. And some of that's in the works right now. I mean, there is a backlash. There's an institutional backlash against this. So let's ride this wave while we can.
There is the question, though, to your point of like, does it make more sense for the Jewish billionaires to pull their money from these schools or to earmark it for a Jewish or Israel studies department, right? And fight the Qatari game, fire with fire, by helping to institutionalize the pro-Israel voice instead of. It's the same concept with Jexit, right? Do we leave the Democratic Party or do we stay in it and institutionalize change? Because we cannot allow Israel to become a bipartisan issue. We just can't. But let me just
The
say,
answer might be both, by the way.
yeah. Sure. In coming from when I say like UCLA is 1 mile this way. I mean, and my niece is a senior there, so I'm pretty in on the UCLA system situation. Keep in mind that they made this ridiculous legal concession that meant absolutely nothing. I mean, they're literally having an in the Fowler Art Museum. They're having a show that is for Palestinian resistance. And the picture, one of the three pictures that they chose to represent this, wasn't like some positive thing. It was a paraglider coming into a peace festival. And this is UCLA protecting now its Jewish students. So there's a lot of lip service going on right now. And I also think that with Trump's new like deportation orders, that we're going to start seeing these sanctuary campuses that start like hiding their students from the government and protecting them from repercussions for their actions.
Yeah.
That's just what I
No,
think.
they'll try it, or they might wimp out too, by the way. They don't want to look. I mean, President Trump, whatever you think of him, he's willing to use every point of leverage he possibly can. So he might say, well, if you're going to hide them, if you're going to give them sanctuary, then I'm going to come down on you with federal funding in every way I can. How many university presidents and trustees are willing to go take that chance? So, there's all look, all of that is going to happen. The question is, what will happen more, and how will it change fundamentally the status quo? I think change is in the air. I don't know exactly where it will lead, but I think there's some positive signs.
Okay, let's just take one more point to the kiddos, okay? Because obviously everybody's focusing so much on college, and we did already touch on the ethnic studies curriculum that's occurring as young, really, here in preschools and in kindergartens, not just high schools, middle schools, elementary schools. They have, as you have pointed out a number of times, this obsessive oppressor oppressed classification system. So they were inherently, and you could say inevitably, always going to be anti-Semitic and anti-Israel. There's no irony lost on the fact that Islam is, in fact, history's greatest oppressor. Their entire raison d'etre is to create a global caliphate at any cost. Conversely, no group in history has been more oppressed and persecuted than the Jewish people. And when we point out that indisputable fact, even with centuries or millennia of documented evidence, we are accused of playing the victim. And let's be honest that our outsized success does not negate the fact that we have, in fact, risen from the literal ashes. So, since it's highly unlikely that we are going to be able to, in any short period of time, eradicate the oppressor oppressed dictum from the social justice lexicon, how do we effectively decouple the miraculous success of Israel and the Jewish people from the perverse and pervasive oppressor narrative?
Well, we have to defeat the narrative itself. We have to send the narrative to the margins of society. We have to get it out of institutions or to make it less of a dominant narrative. In other words, it can still be there. You can talk about it, but it can't be the only game in town. Jonathan Haidt once said, "The problem with critical race theory is that it's like it's cuckoo." And he says, "By that, I don't mean it's crazy. By that, it's like the cuckoo bird, which will always kick another bird's eggs out of its nest, or out of it will go into another bird's nest and kick its eggs out and lay its own eggs." That's what this ideology does. It says no other theories are allowed. No other points of view are allowed. And it has a monopoly over the discourse in a lot of institutions. That's what we have to fight back against. We're not going to get, like, it's wishful thinking to say, okay, let's position the Jews as the victim here because we're the true victims. That will never happen. We
And we
will,
don't want it to
we
happen.
don't want it to happen because all that does is it reinforces the ideological framework that's given us all this problem, that's brought America down with it too. So we don't want that to happen. We don't want to play by those rules. Those aren't rules that are ever going to benefit us. So that's why fighting anti-Semitism today, in my view, is not about just getting, progressives to uphold their ideology but treat us better. It's about getting that ideology out of its dominant role in society and in institutions. And that's the fight. I don't want to play the oppression Olympics. I agree with your assessment, by the way, but I don't want to play the oppression Olympics. I don't need to say that, oh yeah, we're more oppressed than you. I want it to be, we all can participate in this conversation. It's a great country. It's a pluralistic democracy. And I'm not playing by those rules. I stopped listing my ethnicity on those obnoxious questionnaires. I don't check the box anymore because it all reinforces the same thing. Your racial classification system, your equity worldview is, I don't play by those rules. And a lot of people don't want to play by those rules. So let's help empower those people. That's our task, I think.
Right. And as Jews, we never try to position ourselves as the victim, but to state facts is a different thing than hiding behind them. Because here's the thing, the Jewish story is one of survival and resilience. It's not one of defeat and victimization, but it doesn't take away the Holocaust. It doesn't take away the
No.
It doesn't take away the Crusades. It doesn't take away any of this. And if we can, maybe there's a way that when we, I'm just thinking this for the first time, that within this framework, that maybe the Jews are the one thing that slips right through the crack and is neither oppressed nor an oppressor, and that there's a way to extricate ourselves from this conversation as far as education is concerned, to say, anti-Semitism is a problem, but we don't have to classify Jews who, by the way, when it comes to intersectionality, there's no way to put us in a box that we don't fit in any of these paradigms.
No, nobody fits into these boxes. That's my the point. Look,
Yeah.
nobody fits into, okay,
Exactly.
Jim Crow America was an oppressive place toward black people, without a doubt. And are there pockets of that oppression that still exists? I'm sure there are. But nobody exists in those boxes. It's always more complicated. The intersectional matrix never made any sense. It never accurately described everyone all at once. It was always situational. Look, if you go to the domestic violence field, they've learned not to call victims of domestic violence victims. They're survivors. And you use the term survivors. Survivors are people who have gotten over something and they're moving on in their lives, right? It doesn't mean that they don't carry those scars. Obviously they do, but they're survivors. And I think that's the kind of mentality that we need. So that's why I don't want to play victim. I want to play survivor. And I want others to play survivor as well. I've always said, and I'm reacting to you because I've been in these conversations a lot. That's like, we don't fit into this matrix for DEI. It was never meant for us. That's true, but nobody does. Black
Right.
people aren't all the same and don't all experience life in the same way. And they're not all living in a state of complete oppression at every moment. And LGBTQ people aren't facing that at every moment. And there are examples of it when it happens. And there's examples when Jews have been victimized as well. But that's not the one and only experience we have. We're living in a complex reality. And so it never made sense for anybody. And it's simplification that causes the problems.
I 100% agree, but I was going on the premise that we're not going to be able to get rid of this this dichotomy for a while. And so as long
It's
as the
going to
people
take a while. It's,
out.
and that and w that's what we should push back against. It's the dichotomy. It's not our place in the dichotomy.
Can I make one question on a pivot to politics for a second?
Sure.
Okay.
And
Because
then I'm going to have to wrap up after that question, that this one question.
okay. So we everybody is talking so much about the Trump effect, but I want to just talk really briefly about the AOC effect. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was elected in 2019 to great fanfare, and she quickly became the fearless leader of the mean girls and boys of the squad. She was coronated by Teen Vogue as a Disney Princess of Congress, and her calls to make anti-Semitism cool again were a dog whistle to the swooning teens who were dreaming of one day becoming congressional starlets themselves. Grown-ups hardly listen to her, but she has been the Pied Piper of young jihadis, and without term limits, it seems she's on a pathway for a long, long career in Congress. When it comes to Israel, she's just following along with her besties and playing playground politics. When the squad had just three members, you and I both waved the red flags. I was accused of being an alarmist, and now the entire U.S.-Israel relationship is at risk. To be honest, I feel this is the same complacency that Israel sort of had vis-a-vis Hamas. The Social Democrats are now a viable segment of our legislature, and what happens to Israel and the American Jewish community once the squad start becoming ranking members on pivotal congressional committees scares me. Plus, we have our top students from our top schools, and you talked about some that were very promising. There's also the kids from the encampments who also are coming from Harvard, who are also coming from Yale, who are also headed for Congress. Where does that leave Israel and the Jewish community in the American tapestry?
Yeah, I think you're, you know, I know I'm hedging on a lot of these things and I'm going to continue to hedge because I can't look through a crystal ball. I think, again, there's evidence going in both ways. My friend Josh Krauschauer, who I think who is the editor-in-chief of Jewish Insider and is a regular guest on Fox News, he would say that if you actually look at most Democratic districts, they're not going to elect an AOC. They're quite moderate. And what's happening in the Democratic Party is not that we're electing tons of AOCs. You know, Jamal Bowman lost, and it wasn't the only one. The problem is that the AOC wing of the Democratic Party scares moderates into compliance, and it makes it so that they think that they're an outsized force when they're really not. You saw how much Kamala Harris and Joe Biden were trying to bend over backwards over, you know, a few thousand people in Detroit so that they don't alienate them. That's the dynamic it produces. It makes people think that they've got to keep the progressive wing in line, and that means that they're going to adhere to the politics of the progressive wing in order to get elected. I think that's a strategic mistake. I think it's proven to be a strategic mistake at this point, and that the Democratic Party would be much better served if it had another sister soldier moment and it tried to cast out that radical wing. I don't know that that's going to happen. You know, I'll be a pessimist along with you on this one. But I think that's the problem. So I don't, you know, but I'll go back to what my friend Josh Krauschauer said. I don't see that many of them coming up, and some of them are being voted out of office as well. But the atmosphere in the Democratic Party is different now than it was 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago. It's worse. So, you know, and I hope that changes. And I think it could change and it could get worse too.
Okay, I always like to finish. I know you said this last one. I have to finish on a high note, or at least try. And since you're the eternal optimist, I know you're going to pull through for me. I see that this anti-Semitism is not just a Jewish problem; it's really a civilizational one.
Sure.
But What is, I know you just said you don't have a crystal ball, and I kept pressing the crystal ball button last time we talked because your book is so prescient. It was so prophetic, that I do believe you have some insight that the rest of us don't have. So,
Thank
how
you.
do you see the day after of woke anti-Semitism?
Well, I mean, the day after woke anti-Semitism would be that America sort of found its bearings, that the leftist wing of the D Democratic Party has been put in its place. Maybe the rightist wing of the Republican Party, the more extreme forces have been put in their place. That we found a center of gravity, that we've returned to a sort of normalcy in our politics. We've been through tumultuous periods before and ended up better at the end of them, so it wouldn't be the first time. When the printing press came out, there was a lot of sort of fake news and fractured politics, and eventually the cooler heads prevailed. So I think the positive scenario here would be that America returns to some form of normalcy, that and pushes back against the extremes and puts them in their proper place. It feels hard to be too rosy about that, because it doesn't, we don't see it happening yet, but we'll see. I always say, I like to play do the thought experiment on my pessimistic friends. I say, can you imagine in 15 years that we're in a better place? And they said yes. And I said, okay, let's make it a better place. And so that's how I'll end.
Perfect. David, quick question. The name of your organization is changing. Does that mean that people are going to have to find you at a different place? Are you keeping the same URL? Where can people find you?
Yeah, when they go to the JILV.org, AOL URL, it will magically put them into the new URL, which will be NaviValues.org. And I'll be at David@NaviValues.org. I do not possess that email account yet. It will go into effect like some point next week. But if they email me at David@JILV.org, which is my current email, it will magically appear in my new email box. So you'll be able to find me. I make myself very accessible, and I'm always interested in meeting people who want to explore these issues further. So feel free to do so.
Awesome. I have all your links in the description below. David, thank you so much. As always, it has been a tremendous pleasure and very, very enlightening, and uplifting, for this realistic pessimist to, talk to you again. Thank
It's
you.
been fun. Thanks a million. Talk to you soon.